From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 1973, Atlanta native James Shepard Jr. graduated from the University of Georgia. He then backpacked through Africa and South America and headed to Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. There, in the waves off Rio's famous beaches, Shepard suffered a near-fatal accident. Teams of doctors in Brazil and the U.S. said he would never walk again. After 2 years of intensive rehabilitation, James, along with his parents, Alana and Harold, founded Shepard Center in Atlanta. What began as a 6-bed unit with a long waiting list now treats nearly 1,000 patients each year. James Shepard Jr. and Alana Shepard are with me now to talk about how they turned a catastrophe into what is now a world-renowned treatment and rehabilitation center for spinal cord and brain injuries. James and Alana, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for being here. Well, bring us back then to that day in Rio. You went to the beach with your friends. What happened?
We were sitting on the beach, and I got hot, and the surf looked pretty inviting. The waves were about 10 feet, 12 feet, and the waves in Africa had been so much bigger. And I didn't give it a second thought. I ran out, got knee-deep, flat dove, and started catching waves. And the third wave I caught came and collapsed in 3 feet of water.
Did you have any idea how badly you were injured at that time?
Not initially. I mean, my first memory is being stunned on the bottom of the ocean, rolling in the surf and going, I've got to get out of the undertow. And I waited for the next wave to go over and tried to push off the bottom and couldn't. And then I tried to kick off the bottom and couldn't. And at that point, the fear of I'm going to drown sets in.
Mm.
And that fear lasts as long as you can hold your breath. Once the body takes over and starts breathing, it's your lungs fill up. I can still remember the feeling of the sand and the water going up and down my throat as I went peacefully to sleep. The next memory is being on under a little metal shed on the beach on the little drown unit, not knowing what was wrong, couldn't move, terrified, screaming, roll me over, you know, do something. And then they threw me in an ambulance. Everything went black until I woke up in the little operating room with a Brazilian orthopedist shaving the sides of my head with a straight razor.
Mm.
And then he put the tongs in my head to hold me in traction.
Well, so what was the actual injury at that time?
C4 break, which is basically you have nothing but shoulder shrug. And mother and dad came. I mean, my two friends called them. And so they started gathering up all the money they could from friends. There were no ATMs back then.
And it was a Sunday afternoon.
And when they arrived, I think it was about a day later, they came in with the doctor and they said, you've got pneumonia, you're drowning in your own fluids, we're going to have to put you on a ventilator.
Mm. So, Alana, you got that call on a Sunday afternoon in Atlanta. What did you think?
I thought I better get things organized in a hurry, and we did. And we were on a plane at 3:30.
So what state was he in when you got there?
It was pretty tough. The bed was too short, so they let his feet go through and they put slings to hold his feet.
So what was the prognosis then from doctors?
Oh, they said, oh, this is very grave. Well, we could tell that, but, you know, we just determined that we were going to do the best we could every day and forget how we felt about it.
So you spent 6 weeks in the hospital in Brazil. How did you get back to the U.S., and where'd you go from there?
We tried to charter a Delta flight, a Varig flight, and they wouldn't touch it. I was on a ventilator in traction, and I think they were scared if I died on the way back, we'd sue them.
Mm-hmm.
So we were able to get hold of Senator Herman Talmadge, and he made arrangements for Dad to get to pay for the fuel and the flight crew on a C-141 medevac.
And then once you arrived, you went where?
Came to Piedmont Hospital. Well, I guess we thought that if we got to Atlanta, everything would be fine, and it was sort of fine. I mean, they were doing a good job keeping me alive. They'd assembled a team of thoracic surgeons, orthopedists, and all the specialists in there to try and take care of the multiple problems. I mean, we stayed in ICU for a while and had horrible fevers, and it was pretty grim. And then finally it turned enough where I could go to the floor, still in traction, still on a ventilator. I think it was right around Christmas that I got off the vent.
At Piedmont, did they have the capacity to deal with this kind of injury?
No, they were guessing.
Really? Alana's shaking her head.
And the ones that are alive today that I still see, I went and ate lunch with Dr. Carter Smith about a month ago, and he's retired, but we sat there and ate lunch and talked about the things. And he used to walk in every morning to make rounds, and he came in with a Hershey bar and a Coca-Cola. And I told him, I said, you made me so mad I couldn't eat. I had NG tubes feeding me and IVs feeding me. And you walked in with something that was a chocolate bar. And he said, well, why didn't you say something? I said, I was on a vent. Don't you remember? So, I mean, it was if you couldn't laugh as it went along, you would have gone crazy.
Well, I'm a little stunned that you were able to at that point, really. Yeah. But that is part of what has characterized the way that you've carried forward in this. Did you ever think this was going to be your fate forever and ever?
No, probably never even dreamed that we would do something. I mean, it was a fellow named Clark Harrison, who was a DeKalb County commissioner, friend of my uncle's, used to come by every Sunday. He was paralyzed by a sniper bullet in World War II. And he came by and every Sunday and said, you're not the only poor paralyzed soul in the world. Mm. Get over it. He said, I develop real estate. I'm a DeKalb County commissioner. And if you want to win an election, come out in a wheelchair. You got the sympathy vote day one.
That's a hard-fought strategy.
Go get a wheelchair. Let's go. So, I mean, we've kind of been lucky to encounter and be surrounded by people with that same spirit of paralysis be damned. Let's just go live life as we can.
Well, that is a remarkably positive way to look at it. And I'm speaking with some people who have brought that positivity to so many other lives, Alana and James Shepherd. They are co-founders of Shepherd Center, along with James's father and Alana's husband, Harold, and Dr. David Apple. We'll be hearing much more about him. All right. So after Brazil, after you got back to the U.S., after Piedmont, you went to Denver. What was the care and treatment and what was the attraction there?
Well, Clark Harrison had been there, and he told Dad he needed to go look. He said, they gave me my life back. They fixed my pressure sore. They gave me a real wheelchair with a cushion, and they taught me how to live safely. So Dad went out and saw it, came back and said, this is what I've seen. What do you want to do? And I said, let's go. We're not making any progress here. So on the 5th of February, we got on Rankin Smith's Gulfstream. It was the only plane in the private sector here that we could get the stretcher on. Headed out to Denver, I weighed 82 pounds. I mean, I had gotten very sick and lost a lot of weight. And got to Denver, and I was moving one arm a little bit and one foot, being able to rock it. And I think the second day I was there, they had me up and in therapy.
Alana, what was it like for you as a mother of a, 22-year-old young man, seeing him go through this?
You know, we just said we're going to take it day by day, and we did. You know, you got to hold yourself together, and all my friends would come up and sit with him or read to him or try to do something to entertain him. And I said, you know, if you can't come in here with a smile on your face, don't come in the room at all. So they've all laughed about that since. They said, that was the worst thing you ever said to us. I think it's interesting, too, about Rankin and his plane. Harold called him and said, can I lease your plane to take James out to Denver? And he said, what do you want it for? And so he said, yes. And then Harold said, well, can I buy the fuel? He said, no. And Harold said, I really feel that I need to buy the fuel. You don't just, fly out there on your own. And he said, say it one more time, you won't get the plane. And his children did not even know for years that he had done that.
Wow. So remarkable gestures from a lot of people at that
absolutely.
Point.
Absolutely.
But I'm curious about you, Alana, because you grew up, wasn't your father a veterinarian?
Yeah, he was a vet.
So had you experienced, obviously animal care and spinal
right.
care are
yeah.
very, very different things, but had you had a sense of, how the body works, healing, that experience of medicalized treatment?
It wasn't something that made me turn away. I was interested in everything they were doing to him and for him. I just found it fascinating, if you could believe that at the time. But, so that probably was helpful. But we were always hopeful. We just were hopeful that things would be better. And they seemed to get better inch by inch.
In little increments.
Yeah.
Well, what
tiny.
Was the care like in Denver? How was it different than at Piedmont, for example?
Well, the first thing is there were people like me. I mean, so there was this, okay, I'm paralyzed, so is he. And the patients would sit out on the mats and sort of laugh among each other. You've got your legs, you've got the arms. I'll trade you a leg for an arm. So you develop this kind of sarcastic humor that's a
sick
little
it's humor.
a little dark, but it's a survival mechanism. But the care was great. The staff was wonderful. The people who were aides or orderlies out there mostly were conscientious objectors who were college educated to get out of the draft. They were serving in hospitals. So it was a bunch of guys and gals about my age long hair, beards, you know, the kind of counterculture.
73 in Denver, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, I would take a lot of the guys, and I said, if you go buy the tickets, we'll go to the concert and I'll pay.
So what kind of rehab did you have? Because you ended up, you know, being told that you were never going to walk again. You walked out of that place.
Yeah. Well, it started with, because I was so weak and so tiny, with my hand on a board trying to move my fingers. And they'd put talcum powder on there so I could overcome the friction. Then we'd go to one rubber band, two rubber bands. So the rehab was very incremental. But once it started kicking off, it really accelerated pretty quickly. I mean, I was getting real food for a change, not an NG feeding through my nose. So, I mean, the nurses used to say, are you giving the food away? Because I was consuming huge amounts at dinner and everything else. I mean, two of everything. And so you bed your body with enough calories to make that kind of progress.
Mm-hmm. And at that time, were they doing much surgery in the spinal column area, or was it mostly physical therapy and exercise?
It was all physical.
All PT.
I never had surgery. I stayed in traction, until sometime in January, I think. So from October 21st until sometime in January, in traction, not moving. I was too sick to operate on. So when I got to Denver, they had me in a hard collar to support my neck. Mm-hmm. And the physician out there said, well, we might want to think about surgery. And I said, well, I'll tell you what. You get a team of three orthopedists, three neurosurgeons, and we will present the case. And he said, okay, I'll go show them the x-rays and get back to you. I said, no, we. It's my body we're talking about cutting on. And every one of them said, don't touch it.
Huh.
They were too scared. I mean, I was getting all this return and movement. And the surgeries back then were pretty crude. So they said, don't do it.
Tell me about those first steps that you were actually able to take. I know they were assisted on some level. Yeah. Didn't you have a brace?
Yeah. But even before the steps, it was getting you up in what they call a standing frame. So it was a pipe frame that was about waist high.
Right, so like a parallel bar kind
right.
of thing.
Yeah. And they would lift you up and put a strap behind you. I mean, I got up to 6 or 8 minutes being vertical after being flat for so long. And the next day, I got up and I made a minute and a half and got nearly passed out, had to come down. And it was the only time I remember crying.
Mm. Why?
Everything had just been moving along, and now it was going back to what's the typical rehab, is you take two steps up and one back, or three forward, and sometimes four backward. And this was a four backward step. And it was just like, no, this can't be. You know, we were headed for the moon.
That's James Shepherd. He is here with his mother, Alana Shepherd. Together, they're co-founders of the Shepherd Center, the world-renowned spinal rehabilitation hospital. Started in 1975, we're going to get to the story of how they built the center from pretty much the ground up. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is On Second Thought. We will be right back. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. And my guests today are Alana and James Shepherd, Jr. They, along with the late Harold Shepherd, the father and husband, respectively, and Dr. David Apple, helped to found Atlanta's Shepherd Center in 1975. It opened as a 6-bed hospital and today is one of the world's premier facilities for spinal cord and brain injuries. Patients travel from all over the country and the world for treatment there. So there were not comparable rehabilitation centers in Atlanta or the Southeast at the time.
No, in fact, the one that we went to was the best at that time. The others were a handful, and they didn't even have that many beds, so that meant they didn't have that much going on, and it just wasn't where you wanted to be. So
do you think that people, were, you know, if you had a brain or a spinal cord injury at that point, in 1973 at that point, they just thought, okay, that's how you're going to live for the rest of your life?
Most people with spinal injuries, particularly cervical injuries where your neck and your chest are affected, most of those people back in the 70s survived about 2 to 3 years. Pneumonia took them down, and, you know, the doctors would, in my mind, the doctors thought the pneumonia was a gracious way to let you go kind of quietly and humanely, and you were going to suffer for life, so why not? You know, it just, the attitude was horrible.
But so you pitched your parents on this idea of creating a hospital closer to home. Is that true?
I think Clark and I were at lunch. I took Clark Harrison, who used to come visit, mm-hmm. to lunch to thank him for the visit and tell him what it meant. We sat there, and one of the two of us said, you know, someone ought to do it in Atlanta. And went home and talked to Mom and Dad and said, you know, someone ought to do it. And we started talking to Clark and among ourselves, and didn't know any better and started down the path.
We were 24, 25 at that point?
We were very naive, too, that we could start one of these hospitals.
Well, you say you're very naive, but you pulled it off.
Yeah.
Well, we were never wavering in our pursuit of what was going to happen. And, of course, we asked everybody around who would be the medical director, because we knew that you had to have that part to have any credibility. And finally found Dr. Apple, and he was just, he didn't even hesitate. He knew it was going to, would be successful because he said, there's nothing out there, we can do it easily. Well, it wasn't that easy. Maybe it was for him, but it wasn't for us. First, we started with 6 beds, as I said, and leased space in a hospital. We were there for 7 years before we could swing the property and the building. 7 years later, we did move. But in the meantime, the way we got the property was Harold's friendship with Scott Hudgens. And he called him and he said, would you sell me that property on Peachtree Road? And he said, what do you want it for? And he told him, and he said, it's been valued at 1.7 or 8, something like that, for those 5 acres on Peachtree. I'll sell it to you for $1 million because I'd want to see the property used for the highest good. He didn't want a fast food place there. Mm-hmm. He wanted it to be something significant. So we got the property, and he gave us $200,000 at the closing. So for $800,000, we got that property on Peachtree Road.
Unbelievable.
It is. It was unbelievable. Nobody could believe we did it.
It's a miraculous real estate story as well as other things.
Exactly.
But for you, you know, I want to go back to the 24, 25 at this point. What was your original vision for this, and where did it come from, James?
I don't know. It was kind of a frustration that we had to go across the country for care. And Atlanta says, you know, we're an international city. And my thought was, if we're an international city, why can't we take care of someone like me? And why should we have to travel? We didn't realize it when we opened our doors, but Florida was the number two referral source for Craig Hospital where I had gone. We took their backyard away.
Was there resentment for that?
Yeah, because we're over twice the size of their hospital now, and we have outpatient programs, and we have ICU, and we have adolescent unit. They don't have any of those things. So, you know, we said, don't look back because we're going to the moon and we're going to pass you.
And the question when we left and told them we were going to do this, we hired one of their floor supervisors that was an occupational therapist who I later married, and then one that was a physical therapist. So they didn't want me coming back out to take steel staff. But they called up and said, do you really think you can duplicate or replicate what we've done? We said, oh, no, we're not looking to replicate. We're looking to pass you.
It's actually also funny that, speaking of in backyard, you had been a patient at Piedmont Hospital in Atlanta before going to Denver, and then you built Shepherd Center right next door.
Yeah.
We knew we had to be next to a big general hospital for all of their expertise consulting staff. And we have about, I think, 23 doctors now that we employ, but we have to count on those 187 from next door for sure. And that's been a good partnership, but we knew it had to be the right hospital to hook next to.
How do you even go about accreditation and those kind of, you know, there's a lot of regulations that go with treatment.
That was Dr. Apple's job, too.
Yeah.
Dr. Apple, he sounds like a great score. He was one of the founders, an orthopedic specialist. What did you bring to the table?
He was one of what I would call the hot hands in Atlanta orthopedist with a stellar career. And so he took about 30 to 40% of his time away from his practice, put his earnings at risk, and he's still with us, and he's going to be with us as long as he wants to. I mean, he stuck his neck out there on the table with us.
So where did you get the money? You said you went to people and got little donations here and there. Obviously, it's a much different operation now, but how much money were you able to put together?
The building was a $7.2 million contract, and we had the contract signed and had about $3 million pledged and in hand, and sat there and went, what do we do?
Your mother is shaking her head again. What's going on here?
I mean, it was just another one of those things that happened. And we went to see Beaufilet Jones, who was running the Woodrow Foundation, says, Beaufilet, what do we do? We're woefully short. He said, start. And when they see the bricks from Peachtree, the money will come. And I don't think, looking back, whether we were sure that meant the money would come or that he would bail us out. So it's just, there's so
but
many
of course
things.
They supported us, and with that, people in the community knew that it was something worthwhile, or they would not have given. And then other banks and places like that gave seed money. Then they began to give more, and so, you know, it just
started,
it worked out.
Alana and James Shepherd are with us. They are co-founders of Shepherd Center, just a premier rehabilitation and treatment facility for spinal cord and brain injuries. All right, so you opened the first one just 14 months after James left rehab in Denver, a kind of incredible feat. One of the things that Dr. Apple has described about that opening is your late husband, Harold Shepherd, a straight shooter. He says always a straight shooter, but he also said Shepherd Center had never had a down day on the business side. Is that true, never a down day, or did you just take steps to shield treatment and medical team from business?
We never, on a yearly basis, lost money. We raised money for a lot of extra programs that are not reimbursed, but the core program would stand on its own even today. So it's been remarkable, and the donors have supported all the things that insurance doesn't or that charity doesn't. I mean, we've got a charitable fund, but there's so many things, the assistive technology, the pet therapy, the 16 sports teams, all those different things consume about $12 million a year in extra funding.
And I had several friends and neighbors who had great resources, and they supported us so well, and they made a difference.
Really well connected, yes, in the community,
and so that was a big help. And they're still with us. Some of them have passed on, but a lot of them who are still with us are really a force.
You talked about, you know, beyond just the care of the patients, inpatients and outpatient services. Beyond, you have both worked to create a more accessible world. You both advocated for MARTA to require wheelchair lifts on all buses, advised the Atlanta airport on accessibility. What kind of obstacles did you encounter along the way on those tracks?
Well, I think it was really interesting, particularly at the Georgia Dome, when we were talking to them about disability access. They built it, and we said, we need to get the wheelchairs higher. They were behind the chairs that you would sit in. So if you stood up, I lost sight on the field. And they said, no, we can't do that. It's too expensive to pour another 8 inches of concrete. So we lost a few battles, but we got the door kicked open. And the new stadium is marvelously accessible, except for there are no ramps in it like the old one had. So it's elevator only to get up and down. So it may take you an hour to get out of there.
Uh-huh. For waiting for the elevator,
yeah,
and all. Right.
And when they, if they ever get the staff trained, and they will, to ask other people to get off to let you on, it will change that dynamic. It will get better. The Braves have done a fantastic job on their new one. I mean,
we're still chasing accessibility in Atlanta. Everyone on our board looks at every shopping center that's being built and if they have curb cuts where they're supposed to have them and all that, if the doors are wide enough. And every time I speak somewhere, I always say, consider your own housing and have a no-step entrance or one with just one little step out of the garage that can be ramped easily. Because it's not just for wheelchairs. It's for your friends who age, who have joints replaced, who are temporarily infirm and they're moving about. Think about that sort of thing.
Well, I think people do not. And I wonder if you did before your accident.
No.
No.
I mean,
never
thought
about it.
But today, one of the more intense engagements we're having is with the DOT and the City of Atlanta over the sidewalks and the Peachtree Corridor.
I just wanted to ask you about that because I've seen lawsuits, in fact, about the quality of the sidewalks, especially for people who are in wheelchairs.
A bunch of guys that were independent out there took them to court, won, and the city says they've complied. They're going to take them back to court. They're slabs that have shifted because of roots or different things. And even the able-bodied people walking that corridor. So if we want a healthier group of people, and particularly on the medical corridor where we've got people on walkers and things, we've got to get them safe. And the DOT is committed to incrementally help us get there. But right now, Peachtree's the signature street for Atlanta. It's a travesty.
And your advocacy for people with disabilities also continued in 96. This was when you helped bring the International Paralympic Games to Atlanta. This led to a mandate from the International Olympic Committee that all cities that propose bids for the Olympic Games must include accommodations and financing for Paralympics. I mean, this is not just a local change or the DOT. This is an international global change. And Alana, I believe you had a lot to do with that.
I was sitting in a venue in Barcelona, and Juan Antonio Samaranch came over and sat beside me.
Was he the head of the IOC at the time?
Oh, yes. And we'd had to go to Geneva to pay homage to him and all that sort of thing. So he did know my face. Maybe he didn't remember my name, and it didn't matter. Because I finally turned to him and I said, you know, the same committee should sponsor both Olympics and the Paralympics and not duplicate effort. They would both be grander and bigger. And he looked at me a minute and he said, you're right, and I'm going to make it happen. And he did.
That's a pretty powerful persuasion right there.
It really was. Yeah.
But you became a leader in this movement. And this is concerned mom who had been a homemaker raising her kids. What did this mean for you to take this kind of level of advocacy on?
Shepherd Center was the sponsor of those games. And when we found out that they were going to be in some place in Europe and the rest was going to be in Atlanta for the Olympics, we said, this is ridiculous. We'll be the sponsor. So we gave them the staff. We gave them office space. We gave them supplies and money for a year and a half or two or something like that as you go through the bid effort. And then when it came time to propose Atlanta for the bid, by that time, everybody else dropped out in the world because they all felt it should be in Atlanta. So that was an easy thing.
I'm wondering if you could compare how difficult it is to persuade the international body that controls the Olympics compared to MARTA.
You know, they're supposed to provide equal training facilities for the Paralympic athletes, and that's happened to a degree, but it could be even better. At the time of the Games, we had senators from all around the country who said that they would make a big issue of it in Washington, and we didn't feel that that was a good thing to do.
You mean if there are politics or all eyes on something, gets a different level of scrutiny.
Yeah, so we thought it was better to just be about our business and do it well and not stir pots up that don't need to be full of hornets.
And probably one of the most wonderful things that made that possible and economically possible was Bernie Marcus's involvement with us and him going down and talking to the Olympic people and saying, this should have been part of the bid. We're going to support it. Don Keough at Coca-Cola says, we're going to support it. Then Kodak fell in. So when the major sponsors started falling in line, all the rest followed.
Yeah. So why do you think Shepherd Center, out of all of the various causes that does good in the world, was able to get people of that level, the Bernie Marcuses, the heads of Coca-Cola?
Because they were our friends. And it's personal connections that people on our board had or we had. And people just thought that the hospital was the right thing to be doing. And they supported it. And they supported the games and the sponsorships.
And Bernie Marcus, when he was in California with the prior company that they worked for, worked at the City of Hope. And he worked in the pool with paraplegics. So when he got here, he had felt an instant connection with what we were doing.
Well, we're going to meet some others in the Shepherd Center community after the break. I'm speaking with Alanna Shepherd and James Shepherd Jr. They, together with Alanna's husband, Harold Shepherd, and Dr. David Apple, founded Shepherd Center, now world-renowned spinal treatment and brain injury treatment rehabilitation hospital some 44 years ago. We're learning a lot about its origins and where it is today. I'm Virginia Prescott. Stay with us for more of On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. My guests today are Alanna and James Shepherd. They, along with Harold Shepherd and Dr. David Apple, co-founded Atlanta's Shepherd Center. It's one of the top 10 spinal and brain injury rehabilitation hospitals in the country. And this was after James himself suffered a traumatic spinal injury not long after graduating from UGA. Doctors said he would never walk again. And he did. Today, Shepherd Center serves thousands of patients from around the world, in addition to leading the nation in neurospinal research. Well, our producer, Leighton Rowell, visited Shepherd Center and met patients, families, doctors, nurses, all of them effusively positive despite the trauma they survived and challenges they're likely to face. Among those, she spoke to a young man named Ryer. He suffered a traumatic spinal injury in a car accident. We'll also hear from his mother, Annie.
I was planning to go on oil rigging after high school, but, you know, can't really live on the rig on a wheelchair, so I don't know. It's pretty limitless for real. I'm still young. I can really do anything.
What we do today isn't what we are tomorrow. I mean, he couldn't move his arms 6 weeks ago. 3 weeks when we came in here, he couldn't brush his own teeth. So in 3 weeks, he can feed himself dinner. So there's always hope of what we can do tomorrow.
Ryer was just 18 years old, and what he said about the future being limitless. How do you tell other families who are along this rehabilitation journey, along with their loved ones, including their children? I mean, counseling people here, is that part of the rehabilitation process?
The core part is the staff, but also the peer supporters, people who have been injured and come and work for us with the sole job of peer supporting the others. And they do classes on been there, done that. Let me tell you what it was like to get a date. I mean, if you're young, the first thing across your mind is, okay, I'm in a wheelchair. Can I get a girl to go out with me? Can I get a guy? Can I get married? Can I have children? And they start answering these questions. Then you've got psychologists on staff. And then if you get someone who had some issues before and maybe was depressed off and on, you can bring a psychiatrist in or someone and adjust the meds and cope with it that way. So you've got a whole range of abilities to coach, counsel, love, push, shove, whatever it takes.
Months after your accident, you know, you defied expectations and walked out of the rehabilitation center. You tell people the worst and they hope for the best, or you tell people it's possible. What's the range there and what's the right response?
Well, I think for me, the response and then what you tell people, no matter what their level of injury, is look, you're facing a steep hill. And it's going to be tough some days. But in some cases, we've seen people walk out of here. Sometimes it's not till 5 years later. But in those rare cases, it does happen. So you leave that sliver of hope in the room. So it gives them something to hang on to. Everyone's going to bet they're going to be the exception. We all gamble.
Well, you talked earlier about how, you know, there were no facilities back in the 1970s that basically if somebody were a quadriplegic, they're just going to sit in a corner in a nursing home. But how about people who suffer brain injuries who are considered to be brain dead? How do you know when there's any hope for them?
That brings up a really much deeper debate, and we've got some staff that disagree on that. Some who will tell you they are still there and still here, don't give up, they're locked in, and they may live years like that. I think some of that becomes, would that person want to continue with that quality of life for 20, 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's very important that families have discussions about if something catastrophic happens to you, what level of care do you want? Do you want to be put on a ventilator?
Have you ever seen people who were told that you never live?
Really?
Yeah. Sometimes. I mean, we have people that come in coma that we keep until we can get the family trained and decide, well, they're not going to wake up in a reasonable time period for the insurance company or for us. And we send them home, but the family's trained in how to care for them.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen some of those people come back 3 years later for rehab.
Really?
And they're awake. You know, and some of our docs tell you, well, I can spot the ones that will get quicker recovery. So the longer-term ones are much harder to diagnose. So you can't give a family a, you know, in 6 months, this is going to happen.
Yeah.
I wish you could. It's like the spinal cord guys. They all say, when am I going to walk? No clue.
Mm. Of course, everybody says I'm going to walk out of here. Some do. Yeah. Some don't.
There's no rationale. So you can break your neck at the same vertebra as someone else and be a totally different injury.
So you just take what you have today and you work with it and hope tomorrow you'll get something else back. And it's always slower than you want it to be, but, you know, hang in there.
We heard a little bit about the progress, you know, couldn't lift his arm, then could brush his teeth, now can feed himself. Progress comes in a lot of different forms at Shepherd Center, which we'll hear more of in a minute. But part of the work is research and innovation. Was research always a part of the plan, or was it originally just treatment?
Research has always been part of Dr. Apple's plan.
Mm-hmm.
And I think ours too. We believe that you need to research, you need to find a way to move the people along faster, move them along better, improve the outcomes. So you're always looking to improve what's there.
What are some of the big breakthroughs that we can thank Shepherd Center for?
Well, we've been involved with stem cell research. The trial actually ended up taking over a decade. The public wonders, you know, why don't things advance more? Mm-hmm. And it's the FDA protecting us to some degree, and some degree being a little stubborn with what they do.
Right. It's also a political fight right there with over stem cells.
But the last two patients we had, we moved from the mid-body or thoracic level to the cervical. And those last two, we'd gotten the FDA to agree to escalate the doses. So years ago, we started with 2 million. Then we got to 10. The last two were at 20 million cells, and they both improved two levels of function. Now, at the cervical level, if you're at C4, you have no bicep or tricep.
C4 is right. It's like the curve of your neck, right?
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yep. Yeah. So at C5, you pick up a bicep. Now you can get a fork to your mouth. C6, you pick up a tricep. So you can push down, you can transfer. I mean, just two levels of improvement at the cervical level are huge for what it does in your life.
We also have a project with Georgia Tech, a research project, where they have a tongue piercing. And by touching it to a retainer-like thing in the roof of their mouth, they can run their wheelchair, work their computer, dial a telephone, turn on anything electric. And now Tech says they'll put all that retainer stuff in the tongue piercing, and it will be programmed just to move about in the mouth and be able to do anything that you wanted to do on a computer.
Just amazing.
And we've done about 16 patients with that.
You talked about Bernie Marcus working with people inside of pools. You know, people who know somebody, have some sort of personal connection to somebody who has that kind of injury. How do you communicate that to the rest of the world?
Well, I think a lot of the stories that you see the media pick up on that we've taken and they cover them and then they cover them later, or the ones in the spinal column that talk about the progression and the journey that they made. And you try to tell that story. And you also try to do things like the Peachtree Road Race, where you put 110 wheelchairs out there and show people what can be done. You get the Paralympic Games here to Atlanta, and you change the mindset of thousands of children all in a short few weeks.
And among those stories, not just about injuries, but also Shepherd Center making great strides in research, development, technologies for aiding people with neurodegenerative diseases like multiple sclerosis, which has been a big area there. Our producer, Leighton Rowell, went to Shepherd Center. So let's hear a little more from the voices that she heard, Ryer and his mother, as we heard before, and the care team at Shepherd Center.
I'm Dr. Anna Elmers, and I'm one of the physicians here at the Shepherd Center. My specialty is physical medicine and rehabilitation. You know, everyone is like one accident away from being here. Hopefully not, but you and I could be in this position. And I always think about how we would want to be treated if we were in this position. Also, I have the greatest patients and the greatest moms, so I get to meet the neatest people. I have a patient I would love for you guys to meet. So let me see if he's in his room.
Yes.
Hey. How's it going?
So Annie is mom. Ryer is patient.
Nice to meet you. In my soaking wet pajamas.
This is Ryer.
My name is Ryer Moore. I'm 18. I'm from Mobile, Alabama. I'm a senior in high school. I work at Panera Bread. And I don't know, I'm not really a salad person, but you know, 18-year-old boy, ways of eating. I just play video games and hang out with my friends. I couldn't text for like 7 weeks. So when I got here, it was like very good.
That would be hard, I imagine, as a teenager to not be able to text.
I don't know. I was really focused on breathing. Everything else kind of, we were on the right lane, slow lane. The tire like swerved off of the road and he overcorrected because he wasn't that experienced at driving. So then we just ran straight into the concrete median highway divider. And you know, 18-year-old boy, I wasn't about to wear my seatbelt. Should have wore a seatbelt, but you never know.
My name is Annie Moore. I am the mother of Ryer Moore. Well, when the hospital first called, I really thought I was going to pick him up. So I told my husband just to stay and I'll be right back. So we went to go pick him up and we realized it was a lot serious. He coded in the ambulance and he had coded when we got to the hospital. But when I walked in, he was alert and speaking. New Year's Eve, he was having surgery, neck surgery, and Christmas Day, he had a trach. From the day we found out about his injury in the hospital and the extent, everyone was like, Shepherd's, you need to go to Shepherd's. Shepherd's is a place for him, especially with the adolescent program that that's all we heard, that they were the number one adolescent program So we were like, that's where we're going. That's where we started praying. Every friend, every connection, which we didn't have many, but I found out that friends knew friends that knew friends and started referring and just doing everything we could to get here. There was no other option. Once we got in, it was like, we're home. It really did. It felt they're just so welcoming.
Recovering here is, you know, my main focus right now. And, you know, who knows what will happen in a year.
What is giving y'all hope and strength right now?
God, for sure. Nothing else to it.
He said it, God. Our hope is God. But we put our hope in Shepherd, too. Well, let's see. Dr. Elmer said I was a rock star mom. Can we say Dr. Elmer is a rock star doctor? We love her. She has a passion for the children.
They are such a special population. And, you know, they're at a point in their lives where they are supposed to become more independent, then they get this injury. And so it really does change things. But I feel like we here have such a unique place in their lives. And because of that, we can encourage them to, you know, go on to school or to really do what they love.
My name is Katie Kimball, and I'm an occupational therapist. So an occupation is defined as anything that you do from point A to point B throughout your day. So it can be as simple as brushing your teeth, getting dressed, or as complex as like going to work or using the bathroom or doing yoga. My job is to help people relearn how to do these things after they've had a spinal cord injury so that they can do them in a way that's as independent as possible. One thing that I use a lot is humor. I have a unique role in that I work primarily with adolescents, being lighthearted, but being compassionate at the same time and kind of balancing like, yes, like this is a really, really awful thing that happened to you. And like, now we're here to be on your team and to try to help you get through it. I have a couple of rules with my patients. They can't say can't. They have to say not yet because we don't know what's in store for them. And I tell people all the time, you know, I'm going to work just as hard as you are going to work. So whatever you bring to the table, we're going to match it. And you know, you might not be able to put your clothes on the same way you did before, but you're going to be able to put them on. It just may look different. Ryer hasn't even graduated from high school yet. And he and I were talking today about how important it is that he graduates from high school with his class because he's doing school here. And he's like, oh, I have school 3 days a week. And we're like, well, yeah, because you're going to graduate just like you would have if this hadn't happened. And he's like, well, I can't walk across the stage. And it's like, well, you can't walk across the stage, but you can still get across the stage. And you already know that you can hold your diploma because we've been working on you being able to pick things up. That's, I think, the best part about working at Shepherd is it's a place where there's just like positivity and hope. Like when I came here for my interview, I remember thinking that like the atmosphere here did not feel like a hospital because it wasn't about the fact that people got hurt or were injured or their deficits. It was about what they could do and what they could maybe do next week and what they were going to do in the future.
Over and over again, we just heard people remarkably optimistic in an environment where the future is so uncertain. How do you create a culture of hope for children and families?
Everybody has to be upbeat. Everybody has to have eye contact and speak to everyone, whether it's patients, families, visitors, people who are selling something to the hospital. Whoever you meet in the hall, you're supposed to say something to them, greet them somehow. You don't have to stop. You can keep going. But if you didn't have an upbeat staff, it would be a dismal place to work, and it would be a terrible place, and you would never get well, and it would just be gloom and doom. So you've got to keep it going, and that's where the recreation therapists keep things churned up, and so do the regular therapists on the floors who are dealing with them more every day. When they come in and say, we're going to take the bus today out to the zip line, or we're going to the firing range, it's all the things that are offered every day that people just don't think about. We've got deer hunts, turkey hunts. They go on ski trips to Colorado and to North Carolina. They go scuba diving in our pool, and then they go down in the Bahamas someplace for their deep dives. You can come back anytime after discharge and join in these activities. And even the fashion show where the adolescent patients are the models, and the tickets were sold out in a day and a half, and they raised $80,000 for their outings with this. But the more important part of it is that these kids are dressed up, their hair and makeup is done, they're wearing good-looking clothes loaned to them by the stores, and they're coming down the runway in their wheelchairs. It's just amazing. We had a girl this year from North Georgia who had been hit by a drunk driver. She was on a ventilator. She'd only been there 10 days, and she wanted to be in the show. So the ventilator's on the back of her chair, and she had a sip and puff device to run it. She got her makeup done and everything, and she came down the runway and turned around and went back. And I mean, you
that
know.
That makes me want to cry.
Well, everybody does cry, but cry is happy tears. And then usually there's someone who is just beginning to get return of function, and they will run their chair down to the end of the runway and stand up. They didn't walk, but they stood. I mean, there again, you just have a lump in your throat, and it's so inspiring. And patients who are new patients are there watching. Then we have kids who want to come back from Boston and from Texas, Ohio, and be in it the next year. And you know it's a success when they make that effort.
It's just such an unbelievable series of stories. And it seems to me that you're treating not just bodies, but imaginations in some ways,
Absolutely.
Opening up imaginations. But the stories that we hear about medical care in America right now are not normally great stories, especially the cost prohibitive nature of a lot of medical treatment. How do people pay for this? Is this something that insurance takes care of? You mentioned scholarships.
Well, insurance does. You've got your out-of-pocket and your deductible. So the people with insurance have coverage for the care. What they don't have coverage for very much is in your policy, and I bet yours is the same. You've probably got $1,200 for durable medical equipment. That's a wheelchair, a tub bench, different things like that. A good manual wheelchair is $3,000. If you get in one like I use that'll rise up 14 inches in a crowd so I can talk to you and it reclines, and yet they're $20,000. If you throw a ventilator on the back, the sip and puff control, you're pushing $35,000. People hock the world to buy the equipment. And the people without coverage, we end up, if you're hurt in Georgia Medicaid covers you under catastrophic care. So we worked with our legislature years and years ago to get some of that done for Georgia residents. The rest of the world looks at it and they go into debt. We've never turned an account over to collections.
Wow.
We're privileged. We don't have to right now. We can do that. And if someone will pay you $20 a month toward their bill, we'll continue to see them as they come back through their lives. So we're blessed right now with donors who allow us not to have to pursue someone and bankrupt them. And I think pharmaceuticals are the big enemy of healthcare. In Shepherd's 44 years, we've only had one increase in double digits. The rest have been single digits. So when they talk about healthcare's going up double digits, we're not.
How do you manage that?
You have staff that's very creative, efficient, and you deliver the care in a great manner. You work with your staff. You want to walk around and instead of saying, let's go see who's messed up today, we send our senior managers around to all the supervisors, a lot of the line staff, the families, and say, who's doing good today? Tell me a story. Do you have all the tools you need? So you reward the staff, and when we get the stars in the comments, they get a note home from a board member or our CEO, and it says, thank you for what you do.
Obviously, James's accident changed your lives profoundly. Founded, Shepherd Center, how did that change you as a family, this traumatic experience, and then you went right to work? You were mother, son, now you're business partners.
We have not sat down as a family to a table and a meal in 44 years that this didn't enter the conversation. So you live it and you breathe it. And I think I look back at my friends and coming out of college, and some of them did a little bit of volunteer stuff, but none of them really got deep into some of it until their 30s or 40s even. And they were rightly consumed with providing for their family and doing other things. And, my interest was more helping other people deal with something that's very catastrophic and very tough. I mean, anyone that tells you this is easy is telling you stories.
Well, you, young man, you mentioned how many people find themselves in this situation, think, can I get married? You got married. Yeah. You have this big, full life. How do you look back on that accident now?
I guess I was partially lucky and partially cared for by God. I mean, he's carried us through a lot of the stuff. He carried us through the tougher times. He's carried us through the good times. And I think faith is a very important part of medicine. I really do. I mean, it's probably, more important than what the doctors do.
How about fate? Do you think in any level that this was what you were meant to do?
I've had a lot of people say, you know, your God did this so you could help others. And I said, no, my God's a loving God. He would never break my neck. This was one of those accidental, not paying attention pieces of fate. And God stepped in afterward and helped us find a purpose.
Patients, families will say, well, it happened for a reason. I said, no, it didn't. It just happened. It was a terrible accident. We're going to make the best of it. And God will keep his hand on your shoulder as you go through it. But he didn't do it.
Well, what a pleasure speaking with both of you today. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Elana Shepherd and James Shepherd, together with James's father, the late Harold Shepherd, and Dr. David Apple, they founded Shepherd Center, now the world-renowned spinal rehabilitation hospital. Well, that is our show for today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, LaRaven Taylor, and Amelia Brock. Alec Caslow is our engineer, Don Smith, our dean of grammar, and Amy Kiley, senior producer. We always love to hear from you. We're on Facebook and we're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can email us at onsecondthought@gpb.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. This is On Second Thought.